Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, now the second best endocrinologist on this podcast. We have Dr. Susan Bryan, who's amassed a little bit of a social media following, just giving good truth. It's nice, a nice breath of fresh air to have someone not lying on social media who's a doctor. So it's really good.
Well, thanks.
And does a nice job with social media, not like many other endocrinologists who struggle to get the technology to be efficiently helpful.
Hey, you got
Much better job than I do.
Well, thanks.
She's wonderful. She is a site for clinical trials. I was like, are you Harvard? She's like, I'm actually Yale. I'm like, whatever. One of those nice Ivy Leagues. Smarty pantses. Well, we wanted Dr. Bryan to come on because she did a video about GLP-1 medicines and bone loss. And so we were going to go a little bit into this. We have had with another endocrinologist about bone mineral density and osteopenia and osteoporosis in the past. So if you want to catch up on that and kind of get the basics, go back and review that podcast. But welcome to the podcast.
I haven't listened to that. I need to listen to it. That sounds
yeah.
fun.
Yeah. Was it bone or osteoporosis 101? Something like
that.
It's been a couple of years now. We got to do some follow-up for it.
I'll look back at it.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I am the medical director of our clinic, and we have like seven endocrinologists. We're actually interviewing three in the next couple of months. So we have a pretty big group, and we also do the bone fragility fracture clinic here. So we work tightly with, you know, ortho. We do all that like the academic places do. So we see a lot of bone, and I used to read bone densities. You know, I was a certified reader like a lot of endocrinologists are for a long time. So I'm definitely very interested in bone. And I also, you know, I'm a certified menopause provider, so I see a lot of bone stuff in menopause. So kind of the whole spectrum of bone issues. And it, obviously, this is a big topic of conversation right now with these GLP-1 medications. So,
yeah. So, you know, historically, especially kind of from our endocrine background, obviously, we do a lot of obesity, type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes. Thus, we've been dealing with GLP-1 receptor agonist type meds. I was doing an endocrine rotation as a student in 2005 when exenatide Byetta was first available, and it was kind of a game changer. And then, of course, in endocrinology, we do the bone stuff, and we're kind of the bone specialist.
Yep.
So my impression based upon, you know, if we go back to just some of the basics that, you know, probably most doctors are aware of, you know, different types of diabetes do increase risk of bone health. We'll just call it bone quality issues, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yet once upon a time, it was kind of thought that obesity, maybe one of the benefits of obesity was having some, you know, added stress to the bones and bone health, and that substantial weight loss, however that may be done, could be at risk of bone loss and bone fracture. But in the type 2 diabetes realm that we've been using these medications for over 21 years now, I'm very well aware that the meta-analyses show, if anything, maybe a reduced fracture risk with GLP-1 receptor agonists. So it's interesting to me now that with the weekly ones that we're using with such more clinically meaningful weight loss, is there a concern? And people have been raising it as if it's some huge red flag, but I'm skeptical.
Yeah, definitely in that obesity paradox, you know, you think they're going to have stronger bone mineral density, but they actually have some of that, you know, bone adipose tissue that's replacing the normal osteocytes. So the quality, to your point of quality, isn't the same. And then you can see those fractures. So Yeah, I, you know, same with you. I started fellowship in 2005. So I was in fellowship when the first GLP-1 was approved. So doing it, you know, since the very beginning, just like that. So I do feel like endocrinologists, we have a lot of experience with these medications in high risk populations, you know, over a long period of time. And absolutely clinically, I don't know what your experience has been, but clinically, for the diabetes population, I have not seen these be a problem with fractures or bone density. I have had some negative experience with excessive weight loss and seeing that affect the bone density for sure. But as far as diabetes, no. And, you know, looking back at the animal, the preclinical studies, those are all positive. Mm-hmm. I mean, those show great effect and through multiple mechanisms where basically, you know, GLP-1 helps the osteoblasts differentiation to build the bone and helps prevent the osteoclast from overdoing it and eating out the bone. So I think, you know, mechanistically at the basic biology level, they're beneficial for the bone. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one of the fears. Well, is there something directly that GLP-1 is doing to the bone? No. All of the preclinical studies would say they were beneficial for the bone. And so I think that's some of what's confusing in the literature is like, well, if they're supposed to be good for the bones, why are we seeing some of these negative studies?
Yeah. So, and I guess that's what we got to get to, whatever this negative study was that popped up, because basically up until recently, like I said, meta-analyses of the trials in diabetes showed reduced fracture risk. The mechanistic data show improved bone formation markers, reduced bone resorption markers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep,
and
exactly.
Then the animal data. But the concern, of course, is suddenly we're reducing the mechanical loading of the bones, which is good for bones,
right.
With such substantial weight loss. And what was the recent publication?
It was an abstract.
It wasn't even a publication, so it was an abstract that suddenly everyone goes, oh my God, the GLPs are destroying bones.
Well,
that's a different thing.
They put two fake bones on a surgical table. It was terrible. Anyway, that was what I saw. I don't know. Dr. Susan, if you saw any other recent thing, but that was like the thing that made this viral meme of some sort.
Yeah, it's the horrible picture of it eating away and thinning out your bones. And that's a horrible thing to have in your mind if you're taking one of these medications. Jeez.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to take it either if I thought my bones were disintegrating inside my body. Like,
right.
Yeah.
That's frightening.
Did you take a look at the abstract for chance?
Yeah, there's a lot that's been published lately. I actually brought some notes about all of them.
Okay, so what are they getting at?
Well, so basically, you know, there's a lot of mixed pictures in what's being published. Some studies that show, well, like the Hansen study was that great study in JAMA 2024, which showed that, you know, a GLP-1 with resistance training, you maintained your bone density.
Sure.
Just the GLP-1 alone with significant weight loss, you lost bone density. And that is the main message of the take home is overall, the more the percentage of weight loss and without resistance training, you're going to lose some bone density because you're lowering your mechanical load on those bones. But whether that results in a fracture risk, there was a study that was just published. It's that Israel cohort study that was JAMA, JCEM 2026.
Maybe is the one that raised some concerns.
That was 11% increased fragility fracture in older adults who are on GLP-1 for type 2 diabetes versus other treatments, not, you know, non-GLP-1 treatments. And so I think that is one area that we are talking about and interested in or that is underrepresented in these clinical trials are the older, more frail population. Are we seeing worsened outcomes? And I was trying to think through that was that study. I was going to look and see how long that was.
But it was not a trial. It was a retrospective analysis.
It was a retrospective cohort study. Yeah, that's the problem. These aren't primary outcomes in any. These are all secondary analysis or retrospective cohorts.
2018 to 2022.
Yeah. So the meta-analyses that I'm talking about that we've known about for a long time are essentially in type 2 diabetes. And like you said, they're secondary outcomes. It's not like the trials were done looking for it, but they're very reassuring that there might be some benefit. So that's why this retrospective study is kind of like, whoa, wait a second. That's not what we thought from good data, but is it a concern, I guess, is the
yes. The other thing I would point out that's kind of related to this is the publication about all the nutritional deficiencies with GLP-1. But when you look through that study, all the nutritional deficiencies, and I can't remember if it was like 14% or 15% had nutritional deficiencies, they were almost all vitamin D deficiency. Mm. Well, this is patients with obesity. They're, you know, who probably had vitamin D deficiency before they were ever on a GLP-1. So, of course, so you can think about bone quality too with that. Like, if there is vitamin D deficiency, there's probably secondary hyperparathyroidism and, you know, lots of other mechanisms. But GLP-1 shouldn't be worsening the vitamin D deficiency with weight loss. They should be improving the vitamin D deficiency of anything, you know. So I think some of those are also confusing. I really don't think the quality issue is there. The quality issue is there with vitamin D deficiency with obesity or with fat infiltration with obesity, not with the weight loss component of it. So, yeah, I agree. The other thing, when you try to split out diabetes and obesity trials, several of these, when you look at the diabetes component, they don't have as much negative effect. And some of those more negative ones were with the obesity trials with more significant weight loss. So again, it's like that percentage of weight loss being more significant. And then they don't follow resistance training well in these studies. You know, I've been part of many, many studies, and I've been a part of the DEXA sub-studies. So I've had patients in those. And we do all of the nutritional and exercise counseling, but, you know, no one is following, like, did these people do moderate intensity resistance training and how many days a week and how many reps? And just all of the minutiae. So even in that, of course, we do bone turnover markers and some of these DEXA sub-studies, but linking those, except for that Hansen study, linking who's actually doing the things to protect their bones within these studies, you're missing all of that especially these cohorts and these retrospective and secondaries. You don't know who's doing what to protect their bones.
Other than you noted the trial that was looking at liraglutide specifically, right? That where they, you know, they had liraglutide and then they had placebo and they had liraglutide plus exercise and all that stuff. And that's where they were.
Yes.
Specifically prescribing the exercise and got it done and showed the benefits.
Yes. And so in that group, when you had liraglutide plus the exercise, you didn't lose bone density. Liraglutide alone, yes, but not with the exercise. Yeah. But other studies were just not following that so well.
Yeah. And it did seem, get your opinion on this. So in that study and then, you know, between that and all the other studies, it does seem to be pretty correlated with the degree of weight loss.
Absolutely.
And thus, the concern is that reduced mechanical loading on the bone as opposed to any other thing. Because all I said, all the mechanisms seem like, if anything, it could be beneficial to bone health.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So if you're a patient, this is what I, you know, like to explain to my patient. It's like, oh my God, my bones are going to go down. I'm like, okay, so resistance training. But what if they don't? What if they're just like, as much as, you know, this is the Dr. Lift podcast. I have a whole lifting program in my telemedicine thing. We give them all the resources, but unfortunately, not everybody's going to do it. So should they be concerned if they refuse to do resistance training?
Well, I try to get everybody to at least be walking.
Yeah.
So that's an easy thing to do, which is pretty universal. I mean, it's not as good for bone development, you know, as jumping or, you know, hopping or resistance training, but it's much better than just sitting and not doing anything. So most of the time they'll at least do something. And then also trying to avoid rapid weight loss. Like, I think that's where hopefully we do it better. because we're trying not to do that. You know, we advise against that. You know, if we're getting too rapid of weight loss, hey, we need to be backing off on the dose here, rethinking this, you know, focusing on the nutrition component of it, and then monitoring their bone density. So I order so many bone densities on patients where it's, you know, not indicated. Maybe they're not 65 or they're a man or whatever, but if, you know, it is recommended if there's a risk for bone loss that you can check a bone density whenever. So I order them all the time, usually around midlife. And I've so far actually yet to have anyone deny that or not pay for it. Insurance seems to pay for it really well. And get a baseline and then follow it and see where we go. That's another problem with some of these studies is they're so short. You know, you cannot see much of a change in 6 months of your bone density. So these longer follow-ups also are so important, and it takes a while for the bones to change. But if we're following that also, and I have seen that, especially in patients that have done this other places and had this like excessive weight loss, and I have definitely seen that bone loss with it. So I'm glad we're monitoring it in that way.
What's your definition of rapid weight loss for those listening going, oh God, I don't want to lose too fast. We have our definitions, but I'd like to hear yours.
Well, I think for most people, like 1 to 2 pounds a week is very safe. Of course, the higher you are starting, the more rapid it's going to be, especially at the beginning. But I don't give them necessarily the percentages. I think you have a percentage that I've seen.
I usually like a 0.5% to 1%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it kind of falls in the sports medicine, and also 1% and above, you start seeing more gallbladder gallstones.
Yes.
And so like with muscle loss and sports nutrition, you kind of look at that 1%.
Yeah.
Anything past that. So I'm like, look, that's probably about right for the bones as well. But
you're,
I don't know.
You're talking about 1% per
of total body weight per week.
Right. And so people need to understand how.
So like if you're 200 pounds, 1 to 2 pounds a week is that's
really, right. Well, and so when we look at bigger picture stuff, so I like to look at longer periods of time because of the data in obesity, and, you know, 5% weight loss in 3 months on the full dose for a response to therapy, and 10%, you know, 3 to 6 months. So you can kind of see how 1% per week, that's a fair amount.
It is. In one of those studies, it was 8.8%, I think, when they started really seeing that bone loss. But of course, again, that is over how long is that too? But yeah, of course, 5% at 3 months. If we're not seeing 5% at 3 months, then
something's
they
wrong.
Want us to not be on. Yeah, something's not working right.
Yeah. So, when we think back, all right, so we talked about walking. I'm a big fan of using stairs if people can do that. Now, I haven't seen you selling any of the weighted vests that all the other menopause specialists have been selling.
No, I'm not. I know the data on that.
However, credit where due. I feel like, you know, if anybody's going to be carrying around extra weight, wearing weighted vests, it's fine. Add in weight, absolutely. You know, it's all good. It's just kind of funny that they're selling it, acting like that's some magical sauce. But why don't we go through some of the basics? And I know you and I do this a lot because we do so much bone and, you know, we're doing parathyroid evaluation. We do a lot of not just dietary prescription for obesity, metabolic health, but also bone health, dietary calcium, the vitamin D you mentioned, and all the other sort of holistic things we really hammer home when we're talking about bone health, like smoking and alcohol and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So how do you go through that? Like, again, say a patient, maybe it's a 70-year-old lady postmenopausal. Maybe she's, you know, we can talk about menopausal hormone therapy and how that's beneficial, but maybe she's not on it. And how would you counsel her?
Yeah, well, certainly, like you're saying, the calcium and vitamin D intake is important. Ideally, you're getting that in your diet. So 4 servings or so a day of calcium is excellent. Mayo has said probably like 1,000 IUs of vitamin D a day is probably safe for everybody. Some people, of course, have more vitamin D deficiency. In the setting of osteoporosis, of course, we're looking at secondary causes. So we are looking for that vitamin D deficiency or hyperparathyroidism, 24-hour urine calcium. I don't know if you do a lot of that. I love that.
Oh, don't get us going down that rabbit hole. I do a ton of it. And we happen to have somebody on this podcast who likes to spill a little calcium in his urine.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's no good. That can lead to some stones.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, we have a ton of it. And like I tell my patients, I'm like, it's a selection bias, but God, we see a lot of that. I feel like it's a lot higher prevalence than what we were always told.
I agree. But and also you can see if they have a horrible, poorly low calcium right. intake, you can see, I mean, I've gotten calcium of zero. You know, yeah. they're not spilling any calcium at all. So mm-hmm. I love that we're talking about urine calcium, Spencer. I love that 24-hour urine calcium because we see on both ends if it's really low or if mm-hmm. it's really high. So it can help us in both
yeah.
ways.
Yeah, it's very good. Very helpful.
Oh, you should. I have idiopathic hypercalciuria. So
that's what I was telling her.
Yeah, so you got some stones.
Yeah. 600? Well,
my bone. You never had any stones.
My bone. Well, no, I did have one on an ultrasound, but I don't know. It's gone. But my bone density is now improving because I'm on a whopping dose of chlorothalidone.
Yeah.
Yep. Just a lot of that.
It's a little off topic, but this is like 8 years ago. He calls me. He was in some class, volunteers to do a bone density. And he's like, so my bone density is really low. I'm like, what?
Wow.
And got him in with one of my buddies. Found out he had 650 milligrams per day of calcium in
his system. You were really pouring it out.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. And then it's only still just, I have to recheck it now. I was on 25 of chlorothalidone. Now it's 50, but it was just still under 300 with the 25. So I think it's probably lower now with the 50. Yeah.
Well, that's not bad probably. Going from 6.
Yeah, anyways. That's not bad.
So, yeah.
I love stones, so we could talk about that all day.
Oh, that's another podcast, a follow-up.
That is a whole different topic. So, yeah. So looking at the healthy things and in menopause, like you were saying, Carl, that is a consideration and a benefit also of checking the bone density. So I love to check it at around 50 for women, because if it's sometimes it is already low and then we're looking for, okay, there's secondary causes that we're missing, like hypercalciuria, and then that is an indication in the right person to do hormone therapy. How estrogen works on the bone is it's kind of like Evenity, but less potent. It both stimulates the osteoblast to build new bone, and it helps inhibit the osteoclast to eat out bone. So estrogen really has some good effects. But once you're already to osteoporosis, then it's not indicated as treatment just because it's not as powerful as the actual osteoporosis meds. And that's another thing that they haven't done in studies that I wonder will be in future studies is like, okay, well, treatment-wise, you know, there actually are some studies showing in menopause years, like in your 50s, if you decide not to do hormone therapy, can you do, like, have you read that intermittent reclass?
Oh, yeah, that's a newer thing. I think that's... I've always wondered about that, and I think that's going to be beneficial for prevention or
in those higher risk patients. Yeah. So, I think that's an interesting topic. Of course, no one wants to do any medications for anything, but bone medications are so they work so much better even than estrogen when you start talking about the medication. So if I had that 70-year-old person and hadn't been on hormone therapy, she probably wouldn't be a candidate at 70. A lot of times they aren't. So then you're looking at, are there other things underlying, like secondary osteoporosis workup we're talking about, and then treatment thing? Because, you know, we have lots of great medicines to treat the bones and help kind of block the effect of the weight loss from the bone loss. So I wonder if we'll do some of that in the future in these studies too.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that'd be perfect. I think we added, yeah, definitely. You know, the interesting thing, you talk about the zoledronic acid study where it's like, oh, given one dose early on looks pretty good. Is that something that's going to be studied now in patients undergoing, intensive weight loss? That's a great thought. You know, you mentioned Evenity, and people listening may not know what that medication is.
Romosozumab.
And, you know, I was just kind of looking through some of the potential mechanisms of GLP-1 receptor agonists, how they might be helpful. And I saw some little bit where maybe those even decrease sclerostin expression through a very similar pathway. Can you explain, people, Evenity, what it is and why it's so good? And speaking of shorter term studies, did you see the one where only a few months of that then followed by zoledronic acid was just as good as like a whole year's worth? That was, I think it's Lancet or something. I thought that was a big deal.
I agree. And I do have some patients that only can afford a few months or insurance changes or, you know, and we're, so that is reassuring, like, oh, it's okay. We've had some benefit. It's an antibody to an antibody. So we just give it once a month. And because of its mechanism, it both helps build the bone and helps prevent breakdown. So before, you know, romosozumab, we would have to use two different medications together to have that same effect, like your PTH analogs plus your bisphosphonates or whatever, or denosumab. But now you get all of that in one, and it's given once a month as an injection. And it's only given for a year, not because something bad happens after a year, but it stops working after a year. Although now at the, you know, recent society meetings, they're showing, just like the PTH analogs, that you can probably use it again later on, but you know, it's not FDA approved for that way now. But yes, so some of the same mechanisms where in the animal studies, GLP-1 can also be beneficial. So again, not thinking that GLP-1 has a direct negative effect on the bone, but that it's a secondary weight loss effect. So yeah.
Perfect.
Rizosumab is a good one. We're talking bone meds, but
yeah, so. Okay, no, I will add it. But so people start, you know, just so you understand the context, I guess.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you know, I guess the point is, you know, it's certainly something that people need to be aware of. The medications don't seem to be directly a problem. If anything,
right,
maybe some beneficial aspect to it. You know, we can kind of have you conclude with all the holistic things we need to do for bone health between diet, exercise, no smoking, minimize alcohol, all that stuff. And then that if we need to, we do have really good bone building and bone maintaining medications to reduce fracture risk if that is a concern for people.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I can just hear the feedback of like, well, now you're using one medicine to treat the side effects from another medicine.
True. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
But also that one medicine can be life-changing.
Benefits and risks.
It's that risks and benefits sort of thing. So, but like we're saying, we do know how to help prevent you from losing that bone density. Mm-hmm. So holistically, what I would say is we should probably be considering bone densities in more patients. They're pretty cheap, easy to do, very low risk. And it's not that they're perfect, but they do give us a lot of information for like $100, and usually insurance covers it. So kind of we can already see what a baseline is, because what if a lot of these people already had, you know, a lot of significant bone issues and we didn't even know it? I mean, that certainly is the case. Like Spencer spilling out a bunch of calcium in his urine.
I mean, that was pretty amazing to us that was happening to him. I'm trying to remember. I feel like we recommend bone densities prior to bariatric surgery. It's certainly recommended within 2 years after surgery. Along with all these things, we do, in fact, it's in the guidelines to do a 24-hour urine calcium after bariatric surgery. I don't know if people are getting bone densities before surgery, though.
No, I've never seen before. I'm seeing it. I'm doing that afterwards for patients.
Right. I mean, that's in the guidance for sure. I don't know if it's, I feel like maybe it should be done before surgery.
It should be. Even if you're going to check it again.
Because there's way more of a mechanistic risk of reduced bone density after surgery. Because now we're talking about potential, you know, nutritional issues and aspects as opposed to just the weight loss. We're kind of thinking out loud, I guess.
Yeah. And of course, if you think about nutritional things, since you follow post-bariatric, we see you too. We're part of our bariatric surgery program. And especially, you know, the duodenal switch or the Roux-en-Y or whatever. Well, wow, we can get some nutritional deficiencies there. And I don't think you can compare GLP-1 at all to that same, you know, people are so worried about nutritional deficiencies and that. Well, we see actual nutritional deficiencies. That's a lot different than the 15% they see in GLP-1, which is almost all vitamin D. Now, to be fair, they're probably not checking a lot of vitamin Ds, or not a lot of all of the vitamins that we check in our post-gastric bypass patients, but not the same.
Very good. All right, lift some weights, everyone.
What is the bottom line?
Moderate resistance training 2 to 3 days a week.
At least. Yeah, just get it in.
20 minutes, ideally, at least during those days. And I like to tell people, tell me if I'm wrong, moderate resistance means like if you're doing 10, a set of 10, by 8, you're not sure if you can get to 10. That's how much. You should be working on it. It shouldn't just be.
That's the
Yeah, those are kind of the basic fundamentals. We just happen to have one of the most, probably one of the best podcasts with the senior author of the most recent resistance training guidelines for adults. And it always circles back to consistency, basics, yes. fundamentals, just getting it in. And exactly what you said, it needs to be enough way where it's hard to do somewhere in those repetitions. Yeah, all around.
Perfect.
Lots of walking, nutrition, no smoking, no alcohol, and the GLP meds GLP meds don't seem to increase fracture risk themselves in diabetes. If anything, it seems like they're beneficial, but with substantial weight loss, we gotta
comes your risk.
Work out, good nutrition, preserve lean mass, etc. Anything else that you think?
I think just hopefully we'll have more information in the future. There is definitely informational gaps, and hopefully with more and more research, we'll be able to answer some of those questions, like tirzepatide, more with elderly population, you know. So there's plenty of gaps still, but we're always learning more.
Yeah, you know, that makes me wonder. I hope they are considering some of these issues with some of the more intensive, say,
yes, retatrutide,
you know, yes. Out, now you're throwing the glucagon in there, really substantial weight.
Yes.
I hope that's being monitored during these trials.
It is. They're doing more. Good.
Okay. I hope so. Yeah. It's good.
Very good. Thanks so
much. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you. So stones are next, huh?
Yeah. Oh, I love stones. Get love me stones. Some stones.
That'll be fun.
We're such nerdy endocrinologists. We love all this stuff.
If you're or a friend, you know, a friend or family member that could benefit from this podcast, make sure you send this to them and give us a review.
All righty. And well, make sure they follow
Dr. Brian on Instagram. She's great.
Really does a nice job with videos. God, I need you to tutor me.
Love it. Strong work. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.